Philippians, never mind what they said. I seem to be annoyed not only with Colette, but with the frame of mind I have inherited along with her, the postmodern pride of calling things by their names, the arrogance of assuming integrity is a matter of being more and more open, or simply that a label firmly affixed is honesty in the face of euphemism and discretion. Why can they not be believed? Why must our age out them? They wanted to live the life of the mind, the life of perfection. Don't they get to say what they were up to? Your voice again as I mutter inwardly to Colette. You're saying again with that amused affection, you and your nuns, cool your jets, sweetheart. Stop it, darling. I'm investigating the desire for the cloister, not the bedroom. I think the ladies were too. I'll never convince anyone of this, not Colette, not even you, not in our age. But thanks, anyway. Thanks again, and always, for making me laugh one more time. After the half-eaten tiramisu, pudding, after all, I realize, and the depth charge of black coffee, I leave a ridiculously outsized tip to confirm my bona fides as a nice lady. Then it's back up from the river under the owner's sagging umbrella in the rain and gloom to the falls, in the back door as the owner instructed. I seem to be the only one on the premises, noticing lights on in the upper floors of the cornerstone, while the ground floor where I sat by the peat fire is dark. Carol surely is up there. Cup of tea or something stronger, she had offered that in the afternoon. Up to my room, propped against all the pillows on the sagging bed across from the yawning decorative fireplace and dusty former flowers, I swap out the pure and the impure for the biography of the ladies. They finally got one a generation after Colette. Honest research, years of steadfast sleuthing, careful footnotes, many visits to the sites, full index at the back, a writer to trust, Elizabeth Mavor. In the acknowledgments, she thanks for their gracious help the staff of Place Neuwied, where I go tomorrow. Up early, but Place Neuwied doesn't open for several hours. It's still raining, the sky heavy, sodden. This isn't going to blow over. Then back along the street to the cafe, overlooking the falls that are rushing thanks to the rain, lashings of milky Assam in a clattery cup and saucer, my notebook open, paging around to see what's there before I describe the weather, always my starter in the morning. Here's Pavarotti, copied from an interview somewhere. One of the very nicest things about life is the way we must regularly stop whatever it is we are doing and devote our attention to eating. A leisure man. I take the hint and order a big stunner of a breakfast, then head back to the falls and the cratering bed and sink into something deeper than a nap. I awaken an hour later, feverish, hungover from a bacon and eggs bender. Still too early to walk to Place Neuwied, I finished Elizabeth Maver's biography of the ladies, so I turn back to Montaigne as if he were, well, he is, the real destination, held in reserve, but always there, shadowing me, beckoning deeper into whatever the idea of retirement has to offer. I tap on the iPhone to the audible version of the complete essays, earbuds plugged in. The British voice reads to me, the voice my Midwestern ear can't help hearing as snooty. It is not at all how I hear the essay when I read them myself, marking the margins. Not that Montaigne's voice in my reading ear is modern or breezy, or that I would want that kind of louche contemporary voice reading to me. Impossible to imagine Montaigne confining himself to 140 strokes of a dip pen. His formality is part of his age, a world that accepted the primacy of the complex clause, the sprung coil of thought releasing itself in a long, periodic sentence. The page is an open prairie he rides across. He claimed to like riding even more than writing. If there is an agenda in the essay, it is his determination to be nobody but himself, whoever that is. That's the point, to write in order to be a self to himself. In particular, he is wary of sounding or being scholarly, especially of sounding literary. Ainsi lecture, je suis moi-même la matière de mon livre. So, reader, I am myself the material, the stuff of my book. He can't help making this pledge not to himself, but to the reader. The reader, of course, is another version of the writer self. Montaigne speaks, all essayists do, with a personal voice, but into an unknown, anonymous ear. Yet that other self, the reader, is also personal, intimate, individual, and has to be imagined out of oneself, not from someone else. Though it occurs to me with one of those stabs of recognition I'm getting used to, I did have a reader. Across the yellow kitchen table, all those years together, I handed over my drafts, and down he descended into himself, a concentration beyond me, past domestic life, even beyond our erotic life, into a pure and independent reader self, while I paced around, walked the dog, pretended not to be waiting for the word. Pitch perfect, that ear of his. On page 4, I wonder if you really mean. Montaigne says in On Cannibals, an essay I keep going back to, that he would strip naked before you, the reader, if doing so would get his meaning across more exactly. Across the centuries, you can feel this is not a metaphor. Nakedness is truth. It was for us, him and me. Of course, that's how it started. Naked and mad happy, all those years ago. Back of the car at a rest stop. We did that all those years ago. Crazy to think of that. All those years ago. As distant and yet immediate as back of the car at a rest stop. A phrase that keeps drumming in my head. All those years. As if the accumulation of time should assure endurance, even immortality. Crazy how the mind works. Choose, really, on the one certainty. Nakedness of body, of mind, of heart. Nakedness may be truth, but it's not immortality. As I keep thinking with a kind of awe, this beautiful hand, dust now. I seem to have fastened on his hand, as if thinking about it, seeing it, with the narrow gold ring that meant he belonged to me, could conjure him entire. Montaigne longed for naked utterance. He wanted somehow to let impulse dart around, then pin the butterfly of thought on the page. Not a tale or story, not an argument, a thought. Then another, another, amounting to a collection, or something even more gossamer than a thought. He wanted to snare the act of thinking, consciousness shearing into articulation, a loose-moving cloud passing over the mind. I don't portray being. I portray passing. That movement might, after all, be the elusive self, the moi-même, he said, was the stuff of his book. In order to be trustworthy, writing must have a chaotic charge, an unbidden quality. The ease of passion, remember? Montaigne's kind of writing, anyway, had to have that. If it doesn't go along gaily and freely, it goes nowhere worth going. We say of certain works that they smell of oil and the lamp, because of a certain harshness and roughness that labor imprints on productions in which it has a large part. But besides this, the anxiety to do well and the tension of straining too intently on one's work put the soul on the rack, break it, and make it impotent, as happens with water, which, because of the very pressure of its violence and abundance, cannot find a way out of an open bottleneck. Like the ladies 2 centuries after him, Montaigne had retreated. It's because of him I'm on the road, looking for those who believed against the world's insistence on the value of labor, that leisure is really what matters in this life. My favorite sin of the 7 deadly, sloth. Except that isn't the word for this elusive quality, this golden time. Leisure isn't idleness, and it isn't simply an exhausted pause before shouldering the next task. I'm not just hunting down heroes of leisure for an eccentric little collection. I'm trying to figure out what it is, this leisure people now claim they do not have. You're the last person to be talking about leisure. How often he said that when I started these trips, filling my notebooks. You're a workaholic. Always that amusement and his encouragement. Go ahead. Off you go. Always waiting for me when I came back. Tell me what you discovered. You and your nuns. You and your subjects. Montaigne wanted to get away from the smell of oil and the lamp, away from the anxiety to do well. Know it well, the anxiety to do well. You're the last person to talk about leisure. You're a workaholic, darling. The ladies don't quote Montaigne. His name is not in Elizabeth Maver's meticulous index. I'd been hoping to find him there. If Montaigne is the patron saint of modern leisure, surely the ladies are its enlightenment votaries. If he's the rock star of ease, I expected them at least to be latter-day roadies. He and the ladies retreating during ages of political mayhem, ages of terrible certainty, accompanied by certainty's henchmen, ruthlessness. They saw, Montaigne and the ladies, the act of leaving the world stage as the best way to attain balance, and beyond that, to reach the self's greatest achievement, integrity. This retreat from the world was the way to avoid the evil of certainty, the malignant cells of certainty that create the monster of demagoguery. Maybe the ladies didn't read Montaigne, they who read French as easily as English, and more often, all those French novels. They were great admirers of Rousseau. But then Rousseau was famously critical of, jealous of, Montaigne. I had always laughed at the false naivete of Montaigne, Rousseau says in claiming his own greater authenticity. To him, while making a pretense of admitting his flaws, Montaigne takes great care to give himself only amiable ones. Rousseau didn't understand. Some people can't help being charming. It's not an act. It's a form of native generosity, the first step toward empathy. The sky cleared long enough for me to get started walking on the winding roadway from the tourist center of town to Place Newed. I turned up a narrow street to reach the main road to the property and passed a building wedged between 2 others. A royal blue metal historical plaque was riveted to the gray wall, reporting that this was the original old post office from coaching days. Here, the sign said, Lady Eleanor Butler and Sarah Ponsonby had stayed before leasing Place Newed. Farther along, I passed the churchyard where all 3 of them, the ladies and Mary Carroll, their faithful domestic, are buried. I didn't turn in there, saving that for later. The walk up to Place Newed went along a road of brick houses built on the slant of the rise, back gardens overrun with early summer flowers wagging in the rain. It had started up again, stinging in a sharp wind. Hedges and bushes that would benefit from pruning, a hairless dog looking glum behind a fence, a house needing paint, a general air of things having been let go. I saw no one. The only language I encountered, a large, hand-lettered sign fixed to a dilapidated wooden fence. No dog fouling. A neighborhood of plastic buckets left out for watering, wellies on the back stoop, a vaguely tended weediness to the little plots, the sense that here people did things for themselves, or left them undone. On a sunny day, all this would look cheery. Even today, the sky glooming above, it brought to mind the word modesty, even decency. Not poor, not rich, just middling, and content with that ordinariness. The turn into the property of Plasnoid left behind this haphazard middle-class modesty. The lawn, vast and severely manicured, suggested a daft Alice in Wonderland set design by Disney. A herd of elephantine topiaries crouched on the lawn, green bulbous potentates in possession of the expanse. This was the same view of the property in the print from the Lady's Time, reproduced in Elizabeth Maver's biography. Then it was a sweetly idealized pasture for sheep, hummocky and serene. No topiaries. I made for the tea shop in what had once been the coach house. The weather was not encouraging, the woman who brought me my tea said with regret, as if it were her fault. She might have been the mother of the young waiter at the corn mill, or a sister to Carol at the cornerstone with her tea and cake. She radiated the same fretful personal responsibility for my comfort. She loaned me a giant orange umbrella when I paid for my ticket to tour the house and grounds. I went out past the alarming topiaries, feeling outsized myself with my massive umbrella. The crushed gravel walkway led to the formidable house, hardly a cottage. The building was sheathed in wood, painted white over the original and now invisible dove gray stone. The whole thing had been laced up in the 19th century with a black-painted geometric oak carapace in a vaguely Elizabethan style suggesting half-timbering. All this was the work of a series of owners after the Lady's Time, after another century of extension and redecorating, after a fire destroyed the expansion, followed by years of neglect and dry rot, until the property came into the possession of the local council, which had seen to the renovation in the final years of the 20th century, just in time. Impossible to restore precisely the lady's cottage as it had been in their time, given the centuries of overlay. But the lantern over the Gothic doorway was theirs, as were the intricate black oak carvings of the little entry roof and the doorway I entered, handing my ticket to a boy sitting on a folding chair sheltering under a black umbrella. He jumped when I came round the turn to the entry, pulling the white cord of his iPod out of his ear. How dark the place was. Yet once inside, there it was, the cottage, more or less reconstituted after all the expansions and extensions of wood had fallen victim to decay and neglect and fire. I stepped into the Gothic rooms they had known, their much-loved and fussed-over interior, the musk-scented stage for the life of retirement, their retreat from every vexation. There was no musk, of course, only the faint fragrance of damp, the long vacancy of so many house museums, the odor not of death, but of emptiness, the scent of life having decamped. The smell of absence, paradoxically, was heavy with presence. I had the place to myself. Turn to the right, main sitting room, dining room, surprisingly large kitchen, all of it shadowy, enclosed. Lady Eleanor saw to a well-provided table and a wine cellar of note. The ladies were forever either in debt or in frenzied terror of ruin, waiting for Eleanor's family in Ireland to settle something substantial on them, or urging the crown to provide a pension. For what? For being themselves, apparently. They trembled with money worries, but kept on spending, on the gardens and the property, new shrubbery, the damming and redirection of the Cuffleymen, the picturesque stream that ran through the property. Nature often required an assist back to its ideal disorder. "Sat in the rustic seat," Eleanor wrote in her journal, a seat over the Cuffleymen she had, of course, made rustic, "disliked the appearance of the stones over which the water falls, thought it appeared too formal, sent our workmen to it with a spade and mattock." Over the years, the ladies found much to alter in nature's too great tidiness, much to decorate in the house interior, always discovering something that could be improved or amplified or put in proper disarray. New doors for the library, a marble chimneypiece, carpets and curtains, upholstery, and a growing commitment to augmenting the grotesqueries of Gothic design, colored glass at the windows, lending the place a cathedral air with images not of saints, but suns and moons, stars, falcons, an antlered stag. The glass endures. I put my face to the white stag, looking out to the elephantine topiaries in the near distance. So much to ornament here in this paradise dedicated to the picturesque. Hard to say what the ladies would make of the topiaries. Awfully formal. Then again, possibly Gothic at heart. As for other expenses, a person had to eat, set a proper table, not to mention the occasional guests. When it was scowling and black outside in January, the ladies were at table with roast goose and hog's puddings, though Eleanor's journal tut-tuts that they will eat no more of the latter, too savory, too rich for our abstemious stomachs. Meals were a point of pride, or at least part of the rapturous daily accounting of the daily round of exquisite retirement. Lady Eleanor, always stocky, became quite stout. Even the wand-like Sarah filled out over the years. Clearly, Pavarotti people, agreeing that one of the very nicest things about life is the way we must regularly stop whatever it is we are doing and devote our attention to eating. They wore riding habits of black and men's top hats. They powdered their hair, a style long out of fashion. Much unkind merriment about their get-ups was made by visitors who saw them in their old age and found the riding habits and top hats absurd. But the local people thought them sensible, wearing outdoor clothes for a farm and garden life. They had their uniform and were free to ignore a fashion, anticipating Gertrude Stein by over a century. "You can either buy clothes or buy pictures," Hemingway quotes Stein as saying. "It's that simple. No one who is not very rich can do both." Substitute "buy shrubbery" for "buy pictures," and you have the essential value at work here. Eleanor, vain about her journal and letter writing, was happy to describe to a correspondent their excellent larder, tended by Mary Carroll. "New-laid eggs from our Jersey hens, who are in the most beautiful second morning you ever beheld. Dinner shall be boiled chickens from our own coop, asparagus out of our garden, ham of our own saving, and mutton from our own village. Supper shall consist of gooseberry fool, cranberry tarts, roast fowl, and salad. Don't this tempt you?" The ladies' impulse for retreat, coupled with their compulsive tending of the Place Neuwied property, made them irresistible outliers for an age just revving the engines of the Industrial Revolution, whose speeded mass fabrication was beginning to be mistrusted as a false new god laying waste the pacific slowness of ages past. Among the genteel classes, a moist regret hovered over this pastoral ideal. This nostalgia, like much nostalgia, was not for something actually experienced and lost, but for a notion held in the fond focus of the imagination. Retirement was in the spirit of the times among cultivated classes. The ladies were not alone in their pursuit of retreat, even if Dr. Johnson, cultural arbiter of the age, decried such fashionable rustication as civil suicide. He replied famously and tartly to James Boswell's question on the topic, "Why, sir, you find no man at all intellectual who is willing to leave London. No, sir, when a man is tired of London, he is tired of life, for there is in London all that life can afford." I had seen the tired of London, tired of life remark on tea mugs in souvenir shops near Big Ben. This was the period when Marie Antoinette and her set were dressing up in full farm frocks while she played shepherdess at her amo at Petit Trianon, never imagining that barely a decade later she would be delivered to her beheading in a tumbrel, a farm cart whose usual purpose was for unloading manure in the fields. There was a political echo of Montaigne's age in the lady's life as well, his age of reformation and counter-reformation, wars and burned flesh, heads on pikes, and their age of the French Revolution and the subsequent terror, another harvest of heads and body parts, fevered certainties padding the way to unquestioned cruelties. The French Revolution made the ladies shudder, perhaps especially Catholic Eleanor, who had been educated by French nuns, you and your nuns, at a convent boarding school in Cambrai, founded by a descendant of the martyred Sir Thomas More, a typical education for a Catholic aristo in Anglo-Ireland. Eleanor certainly would have heard of the murders, the martyrdoms, of Blessed Madeleine Fontaine and her small band of Sisters of Charity, in June 1794, in Arras, barely 30 miles from Cambrai. The nuns went to the guillotine, singing the Ave Maris, Stella. But before the deluge of the revolution, the ladies shared with Marie Antoinette a taste for rural life, what they imagined and arranged for it to be. They took their cue from Rousseau. Lady Eleanor seems not to have carried her Catholicism from Ireland to Wales, but she harbored a Francophile soul of the Ancien Régime sort, including this passion for pastoral life. Rustication was not simply chic. It presented itself as a saving grace against the dark satanic mills, Blake, and the getting and spending, Wordsworth, of the new world economic order. The world, managed by academicians and technicians, business and markets, in a word, that we live in today, is a souped-up version of the one the ladies and their admirers saw with alarm rolling toward them, and they feared, soon rolling over them. The ladies lived to see France, whose language they knew and whose elegant humanist culture they revered, decimated by the revolution and its bloody aftermath. They lived beyond that to see the further ruination of their orderly, well, feudal values, trashed by the usurper Napoleon. They did what they could to keep ordered grace going in their corner of Wales, châtelaines of serenity. Yet theirs cannot be understood as a life of hedonism or even precisely of aestheticism. They had a daily regimen, as monastic orders always do, a strict rule of life. Their leisure, like a monastery's, was ruled by the clock. This domestic order may have been part of their enchantment, why poets and nobles made the trek to their cottage door. They called their organized day our system. They were fearful of veering from it, as if the life of retirement relied fundamentally and paradoxically on discipline and strict observance, not indulgence. The system was the reason they never, almost never, left home. They had to obey the internalized bells of their ordered day, ringing its changes as it sent them about the business of their enclosure. Their devotions were not a prayer schedule, but acts of self-improvement, a vow of betterment for themselves and their patch of the world. Each day was exactingly scheduled, hours given to study, languages especially, Italian, Spanish, transcription of admired texts, drawing and sketching, long walks, correspondence, reading in several languages, both silently and at night, aloud to one another amid the glow of candles, an alarming expense of £9 per annum, but a requirement of the romantic reading life. Sarah ruined a map she was drawing one winter day and had to report in her diary that a mistake in the tropics has left me nothing to show for the last 6 weeks of my life. I go up to the second floor, look at the vitrines displaying some of their possessions, the flowery tea set, the impossibly small embroidered satin pump, labeled as Eleanor's, the teeny tiny porcelain watering can the ladies used to perfume their carpets, droplets of musk sprinkled from the perforated spout. Then, down a couple dark steps to the woody box of the dressing room, where all the late-night reading amid the candlelight went on. So still. So silent. So claustrophobic. I know I should spend longer in the house, take more notes, pause, conjure up the past, conjure them, but I'm out the door, away from the dark, gothic fug of the place, past the boy listening to music. I can hear the ground beat on his iPod. I retrieve the big orange umbrella behind him, but keep it furled, the rain has stopped, and use it as a walking stick, poking the gravel as I make my way past the topiaries. No, I decide after all. Eleanor would send the workmen with their spades and mattocks to make the bombastic leafy beasts go away. Her Gothic was of the interior. Nature was meant to be wild, even if you had to train it to look wild. I feel slightly elderly, or possibly I feel stately, moving forward with my walking stick, a woman of means surveying my domain. I'm headed toward the nature walk the ladies loved, the home circuit, what still exists of it, running along the Cuffleyman that rushes and burbles, over the stones Eleanor often described in her journal, as she did on a fine day in April, 1788. The ladies have taken their books into the garden, rising at 6 to an enchanting morning. Their morning reading is stern. Wonderful to think of them reading Tristram Shandy, a novel that is a meandering bunch of narrative snippets and essays, another writer belonging, if more narratively, to Montaigne's tribe. Walking the home circuit, as they called this ramble from the house, past the pasture and gardens, no topiaries then, into the rough, down by the Cuffleyman stream and its outcroppings, and back again, along the planted greenery they called their shrubbery, to which they were ever adding and replanting. How splendid, how heavenly, Eleanor exults in her journal that day. Then back inside for a few minutes to write, for of course the retired life is the described life, the life relived in rolling sentences. Then out again with the letters of Madame de Sévigné to read in the rustic hut overlooking the Cuffleyman. I have just arrived at the hut myself. The wood-roofed stone area above the river that now has a sign directing visitors, in Welsh and English, with an arrow pointing the way through greenery and blossoming bushes. Lady Eleanor's Bower. I have passed a bench or two, sequestered along the way, another little outbuilding across the Cuffleyman, several dainty bridges crossed from one side to the other. But this is the place, wrought iron gate, Gothic iron decorative medallions at the windows on the side opening to the Cuffleyman below. This was where they came on that perfect day, in April 1788 to absorb, and radiate later in the journal, the sublime sensation of being alive. "Such a day," Eleanor reported. Then on to dinner at 3. Roast breast of mutton, boiled veal, bacon, and greens, toasted cheese. All this was followed by such a heavenly evening, blue sky with patches of clouds scattered over it, so picturesque, like little islands studding it. Back to the shrubbery for another walk, then on to the bower where another sign, quite faded, reports what Eleanor records for the day in her journal. "Spent the evening there, brought our books, planted out our 100 carnations in different parts of the borders. Heavenly evening, reading, writing." Then night falling back inside within the glow of the candles they indulged so profligately. 9 to 1 in the dressing room, reading, a day of such exquisite, such enjoyed retirement. So still, so silent, so tightly controlled. They seemed to experience liberation precisely because of the limitation of the system. This insistence on the ideal use of time was the point of their life together. The tourniquet of the system was a saving ligature. No wonder I was impatient with Colette's wink-wink at what they were really up to, what couldn't be said in their age but could be named in her day, and even more in ours. Theirs was then and remains even more today the stranger passion, the one little understood or even comprehended as passion. Not erotic life, but the pleasure of the mind filling like the lower chamber of an hourglass with the slow-moving grains of a perfect day, sky, carnations, walking, reading, writing, toasted cheese, the presence of another who wishes to be so still, so silent too. For a moment, don't dismiss it as trivial or creepy. For a moment, standing on the damp bower, Spencer's Bower of Bliss, it comes to mind. It is possible to feel the fact of being alive as it breathes in, breathes out. It's a life. It's the life. It's the system. I suppose it's even love, for surely they loved each other, a love that passeth even the understanding of Eros. All the people, the poets and princes who preceded me to this distant place to visit, to pay homage, to claim connection to the most illustrious virgins in Europe, how was it that the lady's strenuous retirement so quickly turned to society news? That their seclusion so soon translated into fame and fashion. Their celebrity may have changed coloration over the decades, but their way of life remained essentially unaltered for 50 years. By the end, which came with Lady Eleanor's death, aged 90, in 1829, Sarah following her beloved 2 years later, in 1831, visitors to Llangollen did not always find the ladies so enchanting, but simply very odd. The Scottish editor John Lockhart, visiting Plas Newydd in 1825 with his father-in-law Sir Walter Scott, delighted in a malicious description of them wearing enormous shoes and men's hats with their petticoats so tucked up that at first glance of them fussing and tottering about, we took them for a couple of hazy or crazy old sailors. Perhaps their earlier, more romantic celebrity, remarkable to us, was no great mystery in their own age. Their fame was a result, or even the function, of the deepest bond that first brought them together in the salons of their families, 10 years before their elopement to Wales, the bond that sustained their way of life for 50 years. Writing did it. Writing had inspired these two admirers of Rousseau, as had their taste for the novels and philosophy of the Enlightenment and the refined French culture in the years preceding the Revolution. Writing was the silver thread stitching together relations in their class, relations of love, and especially of female friendship, from one blue stocking to another, from provincial whist-playing mother to urban-dwelling socialite daughter, Lady Betty Fawns in Kilkenny, to her married daughter, Sarah Tye, in Dublin. From the very epistolary Mrs. Thrale, one-time companion of Dr. Johnson, to the ladies, and the busybody Harriet Bowdler, sister of the Shakespeare-purifying, Bowdlerizing Thomas Bowdler, editor of the Family Shakespeare. She, too, was a confidante of the ladies, another of their letter writers, visitors, confabulators. These women picked up a pen the way we tap on a cell phone, passing the latest to each other in reams of sinuous, dependent, clause-heavy prose, transcribing whole volleys of dialogue from dinners and tea parties, unfurling descriptions of spring blossoming and autumnal murk from long walks in all weathers. In a sense, they were all writing essays, meandering in their minds, and sometimes taking on questions of the day, slaveholding, environmental depredations, those satanic mills, the recent alarming rumors from France. They were amateur Montaignes, but then being an amateur was central to Montaigne's project, not its result, but its core impulse, his essay, his whatevers. The offhandedness and the intimacy of letters could also convey stray thoughts, arpeggios of feeling, formless forms. All this the ladies and their correspondents adopted as essential to life. But the analogy to the cell phone is wrong. The ladies and their friends weren't yakking. They were writing sentences and paragraphs, lending their expression, like Montaigne's, formality and the chance of longer shelf life through copying and quotation. And curiously, more revealing of self than conversation, because uninterrupted by social awareness. Theirs was a writing world, a small sphere by the standards of our mass culture, moving not over media outlets, but across the well-oiled tracks of correspondence, warmed and boiled over by heated gossip and rumor. In this closed but wordy culture of correspondence, reputations could be made, according to Elizabeth Maver, without so much as publishing a book. Letters were copied and shared, quoted, read aloud to visitors, and of course everyone was keeping a journal, annotating encounters with an eye not of a historian, but a proto-novelist, keeping track, keeping score, assessing and attesting, and then quoting themselves from their journals back into their letters, a kind of self-publishing editorial project that kept these supposedly idle women very busy. Writing, or passionate reading, which comes to the same thing in ardent, bookish youth, was the first attachment between Sarah and Eleanor when they met in their family's salons. Sarah, a child of 13, Lady Eleanor, sharp-tongued, going nowhere in the marriage market, but suddenly on the way to becoming the soulmate to the shy, dependent orphan. It was at first and for years before their elopement, an epistolary friendship, words on the page, allowing the two friends an intimacy that conversation could not equal, deepening attachment, confirming intimacy, heart to heart, mind to mind. The letters flew between Woodstock and Butler Castle, great sheaves of shared feeling folded within the confines of envelopes ripped open and immediately responded to, passionate paragraphs, the subject verb object of ardor. As Lady Betty said of Sarah after the elopement, expressing herself in her distracted but acute way, "Poor soul, if she had not been so fond of her pen, so much would not have happened." Nor are we entirely divorced from this writing romance. A priest told me recently that 40% of the weddings he performs now are, as he put it, match.com marriages. These romances may start with a posted photograph, but no one gets beyond the picture without having to write a portrait to the other, For it turns out real self-disclosure still comes not from pictures, but through words. And words on the page or screen are paradoxically more, not less revealing than that first meet-for-coffee date. Even our way of describing it proves the point. We don't say, "Show me yourself." I want you in words, the narrative reveal. Tell me about yourself. Tell me. Remember how strangely embarrassed he was, admitting he didn't like Skype when it first became possible on these research trips to call home for free, to see each other, to talk? "I miss the letters," he said, almost sheepishly, meaning the long email screeds I wrote every night and he replied to in the morning. "It's more intimate," he said. "Brings you nearer." Nearer even than the sight of the face, though of course we each kissed the screen and laughed, touching the cold, flat rectangle with our lips. "Write me. Write me," he said, meaning, "Come nearer." I return the orange umbrella to the woman at the tea shop, who hopes I have enjoyed myself. We fall into conversation, another cup of tea, and she tells me with a shyness veering on quiet desperation, Thoreau comes to mind, another seeker after the perfect life system, that she used to work in nursing, but now that's over. There has been a sadness, a loss. She'd rather not say, but her life has changed. I don't mention that my life has changed too. She is running the cash register at the tea shop now. She has become devoted to the ladies. She lives alone. Now, a loss. She repeats this word. Such friends they were, Eleanor and Sarah. It must have been hard, she says, for Sarah after Eleanor went. Well, she only stayed on another 2 years, said thoughtfully, as if 2 years were doable. This soft-edged woman, probably my age, running the cash register, she's the one I've come all this way to meet, it occurs to me. Someone who understands them, meditates on loss, weighs its heft. In considering the nature of the lady's attachment, their biographer calls theirs a romantic friendship, saying this bond was once a flourishing but now lost relationship. Romantic friendship may be extinct, but it does not go unmourned by the tea shop cashier. "You put them in a book?" she asks, wonder in her voice. "That's the plan," I say. She nods. "They'll be hard to get." I walk back down the way I came, past the no dog fouling sign in the back gardens, down the steep hill, into the little town. I won't be here much longer. Suddenly I realize, surely, because of the sad woman in the tea shop, that what I will remember most from this effort, it has been an effort to get here, even to be here, trying so strenuously to conjure a lost relationship, is the people who were supposed to not matter, not really, the extras of contemporary life. The stars I have sought always exist in the past, but now, not so much. A shift of focus. The young waiter at the corn mill. "You're a nice lady, and you got here first, didn't you?" Carol at the cornerstone. "Glad to take in a stray. Come anytime." The grieving Madonna at the tea room cash register. I have taken more notes, the ineluctable consequence of one's greatest inward energy, on them, the supposed bit players, than on Place Neuwied, this place I went to such trouble to get myself to. I stop at a flower shop. It's late, the store closing. I buy a handful of lilies, rather limp, all that's left in the metal bucket outside the door. The woman closing the shop takes the time to furl them in a sheet of paper printed with pale roses. With this wand of flowers, I head to the churchyard where the three of them, Eleanor, Sarah, Mary Carol, are buried. The church is gray, stern, and stony at the end of the long, grassy property, and of course not a Catholic church. Their system may have had a monastic tinge to it, but Sarah was ardently anti-Catholic. Part of the argument about living and dying with Miss Butler she made so passionately to her guardians concerned the Butler plan to dispatch troublesome Eleanor to a convent in France. What a fate that would have been on the eve of the revolution. "I would do anything," she wrote to a friend in the midst of the upheaval before they were allowed to leave Ireland together, "to save Miss Butler from popery and a convent." I have the churchyard to myself and don't have to hunt around for the monument, for there it is, a triangular freestanding pediment of gray stone, each side devoted to one of them. Mary Carroll was the first to go, November 22, 1809. Her death was occasion for the monument's erection, to which the other two plaques would be added in due course. A heavily end-rhymed poem, Shirley by Eleanor, honors the lady's faithful servant whose virtues dignified her humble birth and raised her mind above this sordid earth. Reared by two friends who will her loss bemoan, till with her ashes here shall rest their own. They were as good as their word. The plaque on the second side is sacred to the memory of the Right Honorable Lady Eleanor Charlotte Butler, deceased June 2, 1829, aged 90 years, with every title and relationship to a title toted up. Daughter of the 16th, sister of the 17th, Earls of Ormond and Ossory, aunt to the late and to the present Marquis of Ormond. Never mind that her Irish relatives would have nothing to do with her. The list of her attributes, surely written by Sarah, include brilliant vivacity of mind, delight, excellence of heart, and manners worthy of her illustrious birth, amiable condescension and benevolence, and various perfections. All these virtues, the plaque assures the reader, are together with their possessor, now enjoying their eternal reward, and by her, of whom for more than 50 years they constituted that happiness which she trusts will be renewed when this tomb shall have closed over its latest tenant. A tongue-twisting form of bereavement from the grieving Sarah, a longing for death. That is, for reunion. Amazing. What would it be like to believe that? To see him again. Sarah became that final tenant 2 years later, December 9, 1831, age 76. She must have composed the scant words on her own side of the pediment, unable to keep Eleanor entirely separate over on her side, giving her beloved pride of place on her own plaque. She did not long survive her beloved companion, Lady Eleanor Butler, with whom she had lived in this valley for more than half a century of uninterrupted friendship. But they shall no more return to their house, neither shall their place know them any more. As if they had eloped again, absconding yet deeper into their romantic retirement. I wished I'd thought to get a flower to leave on the ground for all three of them. I considered taking one of the lilies I'd bought for Carol at the cornerstone, but that would mean breaking the seal on the wrapping paper. I had nothing to leave as a token or salute, so I just stood and then walked around the stone and its overwrought sentiment several times. My sneakers were damp from the wet grass, and there was nothing more to do here. I went over to the cornerstone before retrieving my roller bag at the falls. Once again, when I knocked, Carol was there, opening the door in a flash as if she'd been waiting for me. "I wanted to thank her," I said, "for taking me in yesterday." I handed over the bundle of wrapped lilies. "How kind! How good of you!" She unfurled the paper, and the lilies flopped out, withered. wilted, obviously dead. They looked as if I'd rescued them from a trash bin. We both looked at them for a lost moment. They were much worse than when I'd bought them, weren't they? They were like a patient who has been ailing but is not expected to die, and then just gives up the ghost when the family turns away for a moment. I was mortified. They'd been fresh an hour before, I heard myself muttering. I didn't know what had happened. And so on, twisting in the wind there on the cornerstone doorstep. Carol looked at the lilies with an indulgent, even fond expression, and then up at me with an entirely accepting face and said, "Well, but it's always thought that counts, isn't it? That's what I say. It's the thought counts." Friend was the word the ladies insisted on, the relation they claimed from the start to the end of their long life together. Not lover or spouse, not mate, certainly not partner, though they referred to each other in their journals, even in letters to friends, as "my beloved," so frequent a term that Sarah often shortened it to "my bee." The word in their time and place had the breezy social affection of our darling, fond but casual. It was the endearment Dorothy and William Wordsworth, also living the cottage life of retirement and poetry in the Lake District at that time, used for one another. The ladies' romantic friendship, that once flourishing but now lost relationship. Strange to think of a form of love going extinct, like a carrier pigeon, a rare tortoise, a lilac or apple whose seeds are not to be found anymore. The scent and taste of the thing long lost, never to be touched again, an extinct relationship. The reason for this loss, of course, is that it is almost impossible for the contemporary mind to read a passion like theirs, "my beloved," as anything but erotic and therefore homoerotic. They were lesbians, good for them, we say. What their biographer calls lost, most modern, self-congratulating, liberated minds, heterosexual or otherwise, see as more fully found. They were out, we say, and then think we understand, as Colette assumed she did, even if they didn't themselves, what they were up to. They were aware of the possibility. They were appalled by the notion. Even more, they cared about the life they had so carefully chosen and crafted, the meaning they had given to living a retired life, the system. But before long, they were treated to gossip. They were lovers, their elopement the result of an unnatural passion. In July 1791, 3 years after their settling in Llangollen, an article in the General Evening Post so offended the ladies that Eleanor immediately wrote to cancel their subscription for essential reasons. One reason, really. Under the headline, "Extraordinary Female Affection," the unsigned reporter described in broad, if sometimes inaccurate, detail the story of their flight from Ireland and their life together as the ladies of a certain Welsh vale. The implication was clear. They were sapphists. The lady sought out no less a friend than Edmund Burke, for redress to this grievance against their life, their system, and the nature of the love they practiced. Burke took up their cause, saying he too had responded to the article with the indignation felt by every worthy mind. What would he have said, I wondered, jumping centuries again, to Colette's grease monkey Eleanor and the amputated breasts? In the event, he was the soul of gallantry, but he had to advise them, as prudent lawyers often must, that filing suit for libel was a game hardly worth the candle. "Your consolation," he said, "must be that you suffer only by the baseness of the age you live in." They were suffering for their virtues, he reminded them, qualities that earned them the highest regard among those who esteem honor, friendship, principle, and dignity of thinking. "Let it go," as people say in our own whatever age. And amazingly, given the high horse Lady Eleanor so often rode, they did just that. They let it go. In the next day's journal, as if no feather had been ruffled,